afternoon, ladies, and the few gentlemen in the audience. Nice to see you here today as well. Hope you're enjoying your lunch. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with Thomson Reuters here in Hong Kong and the Board of Governors at the FCC. A few housekeeping notes before we get started. Please remember to switch your mobile phones back on when you leave after today. We're videoing the session, so we like to keep the mobile phones off. And also, just a couple of upcoming lunches that we have in the club. Later on in June, we'll have Mark Mobius here, the CEO of Templeton. He'll be talking about his new book on emerging markets. And next week, we have a session on Thailand, Thaksin's homecoming. Yes, no, so what? We'll have Pavan Chachavalaporgun, who is coming from Bangkok, to speak to us for that. Now, on to the topic of the day. I think you'd have to have been sealed in a padded room or on the longest long-haul flight in the world to have missed images of the Queen during the Jubilee. And it struck me at that point that if you saw the image of a woman who's been head of state, who is a mother, who is a defined leader of the world, it's really one very strong image of women in power. Otherwise, in recent years, we've had a surge of women leaders come into power. Hillary Clinton from the United States, Lagarde of the IMF, Angela Merkel of Germany. But this is a relatively recent phenomenon. So what is pushing that forward? Well, I'm pleased to introduce Carol Crist, who's the 10th president of Smith College in the United States, which is the largest women's college and part of the Seven Sisters. She's on a tour through Asia, stopped in Malaysia, where she's working on a Smith partnership to form a women's university in Malaysia, which we'll be hearing about over the coming years, and also on her way to China as part of further recruitment of Asian students to Smith. My pleasure to introduce Carol Crist.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here today and to talk about this topic, which is dear to my heart. In this U.S. election year, I'm glad to have this opportunity to talk with you about the American political landscape and to do so through the two lenses that I know best, women and education, specifically education for leadership. While we see no female frontrunners in the U.S. presidential race, we do see a number of women around the world holding high-profile leadership positions, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, IMF Director Christine Lagarde, former U.S. Representative Gabrielle Giffords, Ambassador for Women's Issues Milan Vavir, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, Argentinian President Cristina Fernandez, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, and more. But we're nowhere near the balanced representation that I and many others believe is necessary for successful and inclusive global leadership. Globally, women hold fewer than 20% of parliamentary seats. In the United States, women comprise only 17% of the Senate and the House of Representatives. While on the local level, women make up 24% of state legislators, only 8% of the mayors of the 100 largest cities in the US are women, and only 6 of the 50 states have women as governors. We have a long way to go. The work is pressing, and my own country is unfortunately not yet a model. It's a fairly universal truth that when women are at the table, better decisions are made. This is not based on the idea that women are better than men or that any one group is better suited to public service than another. It's that women's voices, resilient, strong, and from every part of the social and political spectrum, must be part of any conversation that affects a world in which women, as Nicholas Kristof wrote, hold up half the sky. After all, how can any culture address its problems without including in the solution the full talent, potential, and welfare of all of its people? A vivid example comes from the US medical system. Before a bipartisan group of Congresswomen pushed through a law mandating that medical trials at the National Institutes of Health include women and minorities, clinical drug trials were conducted primarily on men. even though women consume approximately 80% of the drugs that are prescribed in the U.S. A sweeping and vital change was needed in healthcare law, and it took women to bring that change to fruition. Healthcare, of course, is at the forefront of U.S. politics right now, and women more than ever have a chance to shape that conversation. Since 1984 in the U.S., more women have voted than men, and a majority of women are strong supporters of putting healthcare at the top of the national agenda. It's not just healthcare that stands to benefit by the inclusion of women in public office. In fact, research has shown that by including women in politics, governing is more likely to occur in the public view, not behind closed doors, and that the process is more likely to include consideration of the government's full constituency. One study shows that on a local level, female city managers are more likely to incorporate citizen input into their decisions. Another study shows that female mayors adopt a more cooperative approach instead of a hierarchical one. The cost of not having women at the table is high stakes and abundantly clear, reaching the level of global security. Writing recently in Foreign Affairs, Ambassador Verveer noted that women, who are so often the collateral casualties of war, are often excluded, both from the negotiating table and the governments charged with sustaining peace. This is Ambassador Verveer. Fewer than 8% of the hundreds of peace treaties signed in the last 20 years were negotiated by delegations that included women. And according to the World Economic Forum, women hold less than 20% of all national decision-making positions. On the local, national, and global level, the need to increase the participation of women in governance is clear, but how do we get there? Education is a clear path to leadership, not the only path, but a vital one. One way my fellow educators and I are addressing this critical shortage of women in leadership positions is via a project called Women in Public Service, a partnership between the U.S. State Department and the historic Seven Sisters Colleges, Smith, Barnard, Bryn Mawr, Mount Holyoke, and Wellesley. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, herself a women's college graduate, is a prime mover and champion of this effort. Her reasoning, and ours, is this. This is Hillary Clinton. Expanding the core of women serving at all levels of government and civil society is an issue of fundamental fairness, but it is also about expanding the pool of talented people we need to tackle the world's greatest challenges. Whether it is fighting corruption, strengthening the rule of law, or sparking economic growth, countries are more likely to succeed when they include a broad range of expertise, experience, and ideas. These words come from her encouragement to our Seven Sisters alumni in Pakistan who are rallying around the public service imperative. As the global challenges we face grow in complexity and severity, the Women in Public Service Project seeks, by 2050, to reach a political and civic leadership that is, like the population it serves, 50% women. This is an international effort that will require strong partnerships, cross-cultural dialogue, and a global commitment to advancing the opportunities women have to run for public office and enter public service. We've recently seen at least one major Western nation reach this goal. In May, French President François Hollande appointed a cabinet that for the first time in the history of France has an equal number of men and women. What do we need to meet the 50% goal at the global level? Three things: access to education, an international network, and something arguably more elusive, individual and collective courage. First, let me address education. Throughout their history, women's colleges have had the opportunity, privilege, and determination to educate women of promise from all over the world who today lead and serve in every cultural and civic capacity. Our graduates are tied to one another through the experience of women's education by a network that spans continents and generations. Yet in many, too many parts of the world, Girls receive an inadequate education or no education at all, and women must survive great hardship and are restricted from the benefits of the norms of their society. Amartya Sen, who's won the Nobel Prize for his work in welfare economics, has demonstrated that the best indicator of the general well-being of a country is the educational level of its women. As one of our own answers to this challenge, as Tara mentioned, Smith will serve as the primary U.S. academic planning partner for the establishment of an academically rigorous undergraduate liberal arts women's university in Malaysia, to be known as the Asian Women's Leadership University. As part of this planning partnership, Smith will work with a team of leading academics from Asia to develop pedagogy and a curriculum with special attention devoted to leadership. With a core foundation of ideals built around the importance of a liberal arts education, and with a founding board composed of Smith alumni, the AWLU will pull together the best educational practices of the East and the West. A vibrant residential learning community, and women from diverse cultural and religious backgrounds. Since global progress demands global access to education, we look forward to opening this new avenue of educating women of potential to lead throughout the world. A powerful pedagogy is one thing we seek to deliver. Another important element is our network. Our graduates carry with them access to a strong, supportive, and global network of impressive women leading in their communities. To name just five from Smith alone, we have Sherbano, that is Sherry Raymond, recently appointed U.S. ambassador from Pakistan, Tammy Baldwin, the first woman elected to Congress from Wisconsin, now running for the U.S. Senate, Jane Harman, former U.S. representative from California, and one of the U.S.'s most respected voices on defense policy, now head of the Woodrow Wilson Center, and Jaya Jaitley, former president of India's Samata Party, now a social and political activist and writer. Women's colleges are succeeding at every level of public service, and Smith is not alone in its success. Even though less than 1.5% of female college graduates attended a women's college, they compose 15% of the women in the 111th U.S. Congress. Why is this? It goes back to the network idea. An ethic of support and mentorship begins the day a student steps on the campus and follows her across continents and decades. Jane Harman, as I mentioned earlier, tells us that it's the moral obligation of every woman to help the women coming behind. Madeleine Albright, the first woman to become United States Secretary of State and herself a graduate of a women's college, puts it more bluntly, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women. As the Women in Public Service Project expands through institutes attended by the next generation of women leaders, with it will grow a new, powerful network of mentors, colleagues, and allies. By educating women for public service, we're laying the groundwork of a global social movement. We've talked about education and global networks. The final key is courage. It may be obvious, but I'll state it directly. It takes courage to run for public office. While we can offer every opportunity and open every door possible, it will take courage to challenge cultural norms that are only now beginning to crumble. As Secretary Clinton told our students at the Women in Public Service launch, ultimately, it's up to you and millions more like you around the world as to whether you walk through those doors if you decide to serve, if, in fact, you dare to compete. And that first step doesn't need to be straight into Congress or the White House. A Smith student, Alana Eichner, who graduated just last month, wrote a fascinating honors thesis on the underrepresentation of women in the U.S. Congress, probing the barriers that seem to be so intractable. It's the first small step, she found, that's so critical. Women, she determined, are less likely than men to take the steps necessary to put their names on ballots. That's where it starts. Instead, she found, women are much more likely to help somebody else, but to put themselves forward takes much more convincing. This in turn leads to fewer women in offices that position them to later run for Congress. Offices like state house representatives, where women make up only 24% of the leadership. Why are women less likely to enter politics? Maybe it's because they've seen what happens when they do. In 2008, we saw two prominent women, Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin, enter the presidential race. While many, including Clinton and Palin, saw this as a historic moment for women that shattered one of the highest glass ceilings in America, research has shown a more discouraging outcome. One study showing that roughly two-thirds of potential women candidates believed Palin and Clinton received a biased and sexist media coverage noted that to the degree that their high-profile candidacies served as a civic education project about women who run for office, they appear to have reinforced or perhaps exacerbated negative perceptions of the way women are received in the electoral arena. The two campaigns provided potential female candidates for public office a view of how they would be treated in a political landscape dominated by attack ads and deep prejudices. Let's take a moment to acknowledge these prejudices because they play an unfortunately large role in holding women back from politics. A 2008 study showed that while almost 70% of Americans say that women make equally good political leaders as men, a majority of Americans do not believe that we're ready for woman president, and this is both men and women. Clearly, we haven't overcome the bias against women in leadership positions. Almost 80% of women said that men had an easier time presenting themselves as serious candidates to the electorate. And more than 70% have said that men hold a similar advantage in presenting themselves to the media. Why do we hold women to a higher standard? And despite an expressed belief that gender doesn't affect how well a person will govern, demand that women candidates prove themselves to a higher degree than men? Because the playing field isn't level. Going back to the research I mentioned earlier, Alana Eichner's study showed that voters rate women running for office as less qualified than equally experienced men. Arguing that voters correlate leadership with stereotypically masculine traits, she points out the difficulty women candidates face in both fighting to demonstrate competency and remaining likable. What does this lead to? According to Eichner, men who are less experienced win at comparable rates to women who are much more experienced. This is not a prejudice we can address overnight. We need both bold candidates and a bold electorate less committed to longstanding prejudices. Why a bold electorate? Celinda Lake, a Democratic pollster and a political strategist, and not incidentally, a Smith alumna, has shown through her research that people are particularly risk-averse in bad times. It would be much easier, ironically, to elect a woman president, she points out, when the economy is good and we're not at war. Women candidates, then, need more than courage. They need the determination to fight twice as hard to prove themselves as the viable and effective leaders that research has already shown them to be. Until we can close this perception gap, we can't close the gender gap. How do we do this? By creating precedents. Thankfully, women's colleges, along with initiatives like the Women in Public Services Project, exist in part to create that precedence. In our campus houses, our student government, our classrooms, or our alumni networks, you don't need to look far for a role model or a mentor. Every leadership role is held by a woman. Now we must work to ensure that our human endowment is mirrored the world over in new role models for new generations. Not all the barriers are internal. Taking a leadership position may mean risking your own safety to stand up for your beliefs. Last year, we saw a tragedy unfold in Arizona that nearly took the life of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. While she survived the attempted assassination, six others did not. She recently stepped down from her seat to focus on her recovery. In early 2011, Pakistani Governor Salman Taseer, a businessman, politician, and strong supporter of women's rights, was assassinated for his stance against blasphemy laws that, in his view, are misused to target religious minorities. His daughter, Sherbano Taseer, a graduate of Smith College's class of 2010, has become an outspoken journalist and activist for tolerance in Pakistan. Of her father, she wrote in Newsweek, "We buried a man, but we did not bury his beliefs." With her conviction to continue her father's causes comes risk and uncertainty. But living in fear, she says, or giving into it would be to let her opposition win. We need leaders like this, women and men who will stand up not just to a deck stacked against them, but to cultures that will go at times to tragic and extreme ends to see their work undone. With education, support, and the courage to lead, I believe that the face of public service can, will, and must change. The challenges we face today require the participation of women at all levels, in parliaments and legislatures, nonprofits, private enterprise, corporate boards, the armed forces, and more. The call for educated women leaders has never been clearer. Secretary Clinton made the case with eloquent clarity. We hope to see the benefits of what can come when more young women decide that they want to serve their people. Rarely do we have a chance to witness the beginning of a global movement, but I believe that opportunity is before us now. We're all members of a world community, growing more interconnected, more willing and able to face our challenges with the strong and full participation of all our people. Our job now, as educators, as journalists, as members of this global community, is to support this movement and the vast potential within it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. We have time for question and answer. I'd like to help the women in the room by saying there's a microphone. So please raise your hand, tell us your name and where you're from, and we'll kick it off. Over here.
Hi, thank you. My name's Rachel Cart, and I'm a former civil servant, but I'm now a consultant. I was very struck by one of the statistics you produced about the small percentage of graduates who came from all-women colleges compared with their level of achievement in politics and so on. Many years ago, when I was about 1,000 years ago, when I was a sort of student radical, I was very heavily involved in the fight, ultimately successful, to make colleges at Oxford co-ed. Now, I had at the time, and still have, some misgivings about that. I mean, I felt overall it was the best thing to do because it was the only way to get a more equitable entry policy. But we certainly lost a great deal, including a lot of the tradition and history of the women's colleges there. All the same, we were sort of riding the wave of history in that co-education was seen as the more equitable thing to do, the fairer thing to do, to open up these old men's colleges to women and so on. The Seven Sisters have not given in to that, as it were. Now, what would you advocate? That simply that the Seven Sisters and others keep their position? Or in advanced countries like the US and UK, would you actually advocate trying to turn the tide and go back to some all-female institutions?
Well, I'm not sure we would have much success in turning the tide, but there have been two very, very interesting developments recently in the U.S. that address exactly the subject of your question. The current president of Princeton, Shirley Tilghman, who's obviously a woman, and her dean of the college, Nancy Malkiel, obviously also a woman, and the incidentally a Smith graduate, noticed that now almost 40 years after co-education at Princeton, women occupied none of the leadership positions in student organizations. And they were so concerned about this that they did a study And they found much, they found something very similar to our, you know, recent graduate, Alana Eichner, that women preferred to be in helping roles rather than in leadership roles. Duke did a similar study, about a decade ago, and again, very concerned that women were not in any of the leadership roles in student organizations. So college can choose to become co-educational, as most of the traditionally male colleges did in the US, and still not provide the kind of culture that encourages leadership by women. And I believe very strongly that women have to develop at some point, and I don't think it's absolutely necessary that, you know, that you can only do this by going to a women's college, but you need to develop a kind of not only self-confidence, but a kind of strong core of integrity of self. And history has shown that women's colleges are particularly effective at doing that, that graduates of women's colleges, even now, you know, after all the traditionally male colleges have become co-educational, are still disproportionately represented in the leadership in virtually every field of endeavor. Graduates of women's colleges, for example, are twice as likely to get a PhD in economics or the sciences, and they occupy a disproportionate percentage of elected offices held by women, or leadership positions on boards of Fortune 500 companies. So I think that that kind of outcomes research suggests that women's colleges in societies which, despite the fact that many barriers have come down, are still, you don't see equal representation of men and women at the top levels of leadership.
Over here, Kathy, and then I'll move.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Kathy Yang of Reuters TV. I work with Tara. As you come here to Asia and get closer to emerging markets, developing economies, developing nations, you would notice that there are political leaders in our midst. We have before in Indonesia's Megawati Soekarnoputri, we have Myanmar's Aung San Suu Kyi, and Yingluck Shinawat in Thailand. Do you think that emerging markets and developing markets and the citizens amongst these countries are more accepting of political leaders that are women as against developed economies as the U.S.? Because in your speech, you said that people are more accepting in the U.S. of male leaders at a time of crisis. And indeed, it seems in the financial markets we are in crisis. And yeah. We have women political leaders, female political leaders in our midst.
That's an extremely interesting question. I think that the situations, the social and cultural dynamics are quite different. And I think that in Asia, a really interesting kind of corollary question to the question you asked is how to assess the issue of dynastic relationships. And often women who are in power in developing countries emerge from kind of dynastic constellations of various sorts in their countries. I think about Indira Gandhi or Benazir Bhutto as two very prominent examples. So that's a different problem, but I think it's an equivalent problem. One might even, if you think back to the U.S., and you think about Hillary Clinton's success, I mean, it did indeed run for elective office, but only after she was the wife of a president of the United States. So you might say that's a kind of U.S. equivalent of a kind of dynastic push to power. But so I think that it's not so simple as a kind of census analysis might suggest.
Over here.
I'm Bob Meyer, PharmaLink International. I wanted to go back to your discussion about education, because in the United States now, more than 50% of entering students are women. I think it's averages around 55%.
58.
58. And I believe the number who actually graduate is even higher.
That's right.
So, you know, your contrast between all women's colleges and the higher success rate in terms of leadership from that group is well known and understood. But I, in the general university and college populations now, it's becoming almost two-thirds, one-third in terms of women to men. And in graduate faculties, for example, in veterinary schools, it's become a women's profession. I mean, there are more women vets out there now, and the number in vet schools is much higher in the future. So with that in mind, do you think of that as, I mean, that's obviously good news, but do you think of that as also accelerating the change that you're trying to encourage in terms of leadership?
Well, it's certainly a wonderful sign, but I think that, again, you need a kind of finer-grained analysis. And two factors. One is if you cut the percentage of students in the United States by gender and also income band, you discover something very interesting. Women far outnumber men. In both numbers and percentages at lower income bands. So women from low income backgrounds, I guess the conclusion would be, think it's tremendously advantageous to seek more schooling to increase their economic prospects. What you see is a kind of cross. When you look at the very highest income bands, the percentage of men is greater than the percentage of women in higher education. The other thing to look at carefully is disciplines. So there is a majority of women in higher education right now, certain areas are still overwhelmingly male, particularly engineering and some of the sciences, areas that are so important for leadership today. And then, of course, you need to look at outcomes so that women for some time now, almost 30 years, have been in the majority of students in both law school and medical school, and yet partners in law firms are still overwhelmingly male. The leadership in our major medical schools is overwhelmingly male. And what we see is something that fascinates me, which is when a profession becomes feminized, as you're suggesting about veterinary medicine, it can often decline in prestige and income.
Over here, we'll start with Karen.
Hi, my name is Karen Chapun. I used to work for Thomson Reuters until recently. Carol, listening to your very inspiring speech, it just jumped into my mind to ask, if I may, a personal question. So have you ever considered yourself going into politics? Or do you believe that, you know, in the current position where you are, you can better help women to become leaders themselves, which would go in the direction of what you were describing, actually, as a woman characteristic?
Yeah, that's really an interesting question. No, is the personal answer. But I think it's really interesting to think about what are the paths to a life in, to a career in politics. And it really does begin, as our students' thesis suggests, it usually begins with women who have such a passion for it that they seek out local offices. And so it's relatively rare in U.S. politics that somebody, you know, kind of comes in at a level of national prominence, that women tend to work their way up through positions in the party, local offices, and those are the career paths that are still so much more typical of men than they are of women. And I think there are a number of factors. One is the women's own more complex time pressures in the decades in the 30s, you know, when women are in their 30s and 40s, in terms of raising a family, caring for a family, that often makes women's career paths somewhat different from men's career paths. It's striking to me that Sarah Palin,
who did work her way through local office, came from a very sparsely populated state where there didn't, you know, the distance between the, you know, Wasilla and Anchorage is shorter than perhaps it might be between, you know, a small town and New York and Albany. And also, you know, Michelle Bachmann also comes from a small state. And so I think that there's just there are a multitude of factors that, you know, to develop an adequate analysis of the question, you really need to think about the entire career path rather than just the point of running for the nationally prominent office. Yeah. It's also a question, I should say, I should add two more things to what I said. In U.S. politics, at least, it's very much a question of money. It's gotten so expensive to run for office. And it's also a question of networks and, you know, it's self-perpetuating. You've got, you know, men's networks when they think of who's going to run for this open state representative seat. That they tend to think of their male networks rather than a woman's network.
Hi, I'm Meredith of Women Media Networks. Thank you so much for your comments this morning. Really inspiring and thought-provoking. And I'm especially thinking about the second two on your list of three, the networks and the courage, mm-hmm. and whether or not those must be interrelated, as your previous comment just said, it must be easier to have that courage if you have a connected community behind you. Mm-hmm. And also, is it possible to teach and cultivate that courage, or is it something like you just sort of have to have from the cradle?
Well, I think it's certainly possible to cultivate that courage. It was really striking to me at the launch of the Women in Public Service Initiative in Washington, D.C. In December of last year. Christine Lagarde and Hillary Clinton were two of the keynote speakers, and they both said the most important thing that women needed to cultivate was the willingness to take risk. And they felt that women were too often too cautious, not willing to take risks. Christine Lagarde was the first speaker, and it was really a memorable moment because she began her speech by talking about the risk that Hillary Clinton took when she chose to run for president, and said, when you choose to do something like that, you have to face the possibility of failure, as indeed Hillary Clinton did. And so it's striking to me that women who have gotten into those positions of prominence talk so much about risk and the development of risk-taking. And yes, I do believe that that's something that one can cultivate, that one can, if not exactly teach, one can encourage in smaller stakes situations. There's a kind of mantra in venture capitalism that if you haven't failed, you're no good. And I think that people have to be more willing, paradoxically, to accept the possibility of failure in order to succeed.
We have time for one more question. We'll go back to where we started.
Yeah, sorry, Rachel Carton again. I'd like to ask about what do you think about what might be called looksism? You touched on that when you were talking about the presentational problems of women politicians. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me it's a more general problem. You know, it seems to me that in the 19th and early, and really for a lot of the 20th century, it was much more acceptable for a woman to be unattractive. Mm-hmm. But for example, there's been an interesting case in the UK recently, a woman called Mary Beard, who is a very distinguished professor of classics at Cambridge University.
Yes, I know her.
Gave a present, but was, I didn't see the program, I just read about it on news sites and so on, was fronting a series of TV programs about the ancient world, which is her speciality. Mm-hmm. But there was an incredible backlash of criticism on the grounds that she was too ugly. She was somebody who doesn't dye hair. She's a 50-year-old woman. Mm-hmm. She doesn't dye her hair. She mm-hmm. doesn't wear makeup. And she said, this is what a 50-year-old woman looks like. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how the debate ended up, whether there were more in favor of her or more against, but I was really thinking that 30, 40 years ago, that debate wouldn't have happened because we knew what women academics looked like and there wasn't a pressure on them to be a glamour girl as well.
I think you make a very, very important point. The amount of commentary that's been devoted to Hillary Clinton's appearance is deeply discouraging. I mean, we don't have volumes of commentary about Joe Biden's appearance. I mean, it's just, it would be laughable if people said the things about male politicians as they say about female politicians. So I agree that it's a deep prejudice. It's a deep prejudice against age in a woman and a kind of bias in favor of attractiveness. And one of the things that I found quite discouraging about Sarah Palin's candidacy and Michelle Bachmann's candidacy is it's almost as if I saw it as a kind of stage in the 1970s when there was an effort to for affirmative action in the United States for women. And often groups of men that felt under some pressure to find a woman would identify somebody who was, looked very glamorous, but was dopey and incapable. And that seems to me the deep message behind certainly Sarah Palin's candidacy, who was just so unqualified. So I think that's a very big barrier and important to articulate.
Just to end things on a hopefully positive note, because that's a really thought-provoking comment to take away. Competition, ability to compete, desire to compete. Yes. You obviously meet women all over the world. Do you find that the younger generations have that in them?
Yes, I certainly do think younger generations have that in them. And I think in part I want to say something about Title IX, which is the legislation in the United States that mandated gender equity and has had one of the biggest impacts in sports and athletic opportunities for women. And I think that the growing presence of women's sports has had a kind of cultural a shaping influence on that willingness to compete. I also think that there is a kind of sense of pride in some areas of the country, areas of the world that are developing very fast that affects women as well as men, a kind of a very healthy sort of competitive spirit. But so I do see a greater willingness and perhaps that will to compete, which perhaps will lead to more risk-taking because you obviously can't compete without taking risks.
It's 2:00. I think we'll leave it on that note. Carol Crist, as ever, a small gift from the FCC for our speakers coming to visit. And thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you very much. Thank you.